Annalee Howling, thank you so much for joining me on How I Got Through It. It's so nice to see you. I've only seen you on Instagram, but it's so nice to see your beautiful face. And I'm really excited to have this conversation.
Thank you for the invitation. It feels really serendipitous and exciting. I feel like this is going to be juicy.
I know. I feel it too. So let's start with, I just love to ask my guests, how are you doing really? Like in this moment, how are you feeling mentally, spiritually, physically?
Big question. So how am I feeling really? A little bit disconnected, in all honesty. By that, I mean, there's been a huge volume of new in a very short space of time. So single parent, got a young daughter, and she's just started, I'm not allowed to say it, but big school. And there's just been, I don't remember the last time I had a learning curve so steep. So then you have this big desire to get it right for her. Like, I don't want to let her down. You know, I don't want to be the person that, it sounds so simple, but I don't want to forget an item in her bag she might need. And I want to make sure she's sort of got everything that she needs, again, emotionally as well.
Have you always wanted to have a daughter? Has that always been like a strong desire for you?
If I knew it would be her, I would have probably done it sooner. She's just epic. And I'm obviously biased, but we just have this amazing connection. But I was scared of being a parent. I'm really happy to own that. You know, I had a traumatic childhood myself and fought for independence, like really fought and still have to sometimes to make things work. And I had grown up at a time where in an industry where I worked, becoming a mother and having a child was kind of seen like you had a bit of a black mark against your name and that I wouldn't have had the same opportunities. So I became a mother when I was 34. My daughter and now. So that was maybe later, but I definitely was very keen to try and build security for myself there. So answer would be deep down inside, yes, absolutely. But I was very scared of what it might have meant and if I had to change parts of myself.
Yeah. I asked that because you're a trauma specialist and I heard you say that you had a traumatic childhood. Can you take me back to maybe a moment in your childhood? What is that first memory that you can think of that was traumatic for you?
So I have a very clear memory, was a core memory. And on a holiday with my family, my mother, who's a hypochondriac, was unwell that evening. And in a restaurant with my father and my younger brother, and my brother having a bit squabble, he knows what about. Just nothing, just across the table. And my father punched me in the face. Oof. I was the same age as my daughter, and punched me in the face.
Yeah.
And what did it? And the memory was, I know it was his left hand, because it was his wedding ring that came straight towards my nose, and my nose just, there was blood everywhere. And I remember being so shocked and looking around this restaurant and everyone was trying to give advice as to how to stop a nosebleed because people assumed I was having a nosebleed. I remember getting back to the apartment and my father had been violent to me before, but this was a new level and in public as well. And him and my mother looking to one another and I could sort of see her looking a bit. There was no question about what had you done. And the worst part of all of it, when you go through trauma and you unpick where shame comes from, they came up with a story and they said to me, because I was seven, I was the same age my daughter is now. And they were like, well, you did say that you'd never had a nosebleed because boys in my class were beginning to go through adolescence. And sometimes with boys when they're going through adolescence, it can bring on nosebleed. Also with girls. And I'd obviously been talking about that happening at school. So-and-so had a nosebleed today. And they were like, well, you did say you'd never had a nosebleed. A bit like, well, you did say you've always wanted a pony,
right?
You know, and I remember thinking, this is really fucked up.
Yeah,
you know, this is really fucked up. But I'm seven. I'm in Spain. I'm with my family. This is what they're saying. They're looking at me like, well, you did say you'd never had a nosebleed. You know, aren't you lucky that we gave you that? Maybe tomorrow you'll get an ice cream instead. You know. So I knew it was wrong. But also, what can you do? I can't get out of here. I can't get any of my needs met. So you end up fawning and just trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. But yeah, that for many years lived with me in such a strong way. It drove so many things, good and bad behaviors, I would say.
And you were seven when that happened?
Yeah.
I wonder if there's something to do with that happening to you at seven and your daughter being seven now that you feel like, I just want to do everything right.
Definitely. I think generally speaking, we look at our own childhoods and whatever we see as being negative, we try and go the other way, right? But do remember, he told me that I made him do it, you see. So I was so rude, or I was so poorly behaved at the table that I made him do it. I was so mad. Shame language is I am. Shame is something that's actually really hard to discuss and talk about. So if you're told often enough that you are bad and you are stupid and you are wrong and you're not good enough, you will start to develop an internal belief that, well, this person who brought me to this earth and is supposed to love me without condition, even they can't stand me.
Right.
You know, I've made him beat me in a restaurant. I must be so bad. Therefore, I am bad. And so I would go through situations, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, fundamentally having this internal belief of mine, I am bad, living there all the time. So you can imagine the relationships I may have chosen or jobs or other things. Mm-hmm. So therefore, this is going to sort of be a lens I'm going to see the world through. And one of the exercises that you can do is you place a child in the seat of either anyone listening, maybe they've got a niece or a nephew or a friend's child, or even your own inner child. If you're going to do like a memory of this yourself to try and get some healing work and reframe it, is there anything, if I put her in that seat, that she could say or do that would be even worthy of anything more than maybe a stern word, like, please be quiet? But there is nothing she could say at 7 years old that would ever be worthy of physical violence in any regard. And when you see that and you realize that, you feel this sense of, oh God, it really wasn't my fault, despite Rush doing that. Mm-hmm. But shame is in an irrational, felt, physical, somatic sense, like I say, that drives so many things. So yes, absolutely. She was a huge part of my healing, is understanding that there is nothing excusable for what happened.
Yeah. And shame and guilt too are like cousins, because I feel like once you experience something like that, I think about my own childhood and feeling so much shame. All of those things, I think, come into play. Like when I think about not only my relationship to self and maybe what I've been carrying through my 20s and my 30s. And my 30s for me have been quite transformative in a sense that I've been now been really like putting my hands beneath the soil and being like, what the hell is going on here? What are these roots that I'm feeling? Where is this coming from? And really digging into like my own relationship to myself and trying to figure out how to kind of uproot some of these things that have been so deep rooted from my childhood. So for anybody that's listening, how would you suggest that they start to, I don't know, uproot some of these things for them?
I work with people every day that have unfortunately struggled mainly with family members in some way and come to me at a later point in life and are really struggling with shame and guilt that they've got from events exactly as you're describing now. So when you are experiencing trauma, there's five trauma responses. There's fight, flight, freeze. Most people know about those. Flop, pass out on the spot. Fawn, which is to try and placate someone when you're in so much danger. So I work a lot with victims of sexual assault, incredibly often.
Yeah.
Huge amounts of shame that get carried if you fawn. And I think most of us would do the same, but that bit, not talking about that at the moment. But what happens with trauma that people don't understand, and I didn't, and I had a lot of guilt with some of these events and shame that had happened to me, is that your brain, when this was happening, so when either you were aware that something really bad was happening, your mom was in danger, whatever was going on, all the blood moves away from your prefrontal cortex and your Broca's area. Broca's is language, words, things you need to say. And the prefrontal cortex is dates, times, cognitive information. You don't need that right now. What you need to do is to stay alive, because you also wouldn't have known if that was a safe situation for you. And or you need to help your mom, who's your primary caregiver. So all the blood comes from these two areas. I'm pointing to my forehead for people that, and on the top of my head. And the blood gets rerouted to your amygdala, your limbic system, or sometimes your prehistoric brain or your lizard brain, it can be referred to. It's all gone there, okay? And it works so much faster than your prefrontal cortex. So this is the really important thing for me to give to you today. You did not choose your trauma response. It was selected for you and it was designed to keep you alive. So your trauma response was flight. Somebody else, I had an attempted burglary. There was someone stood outside my window. I froze on the spot. I was so afraid I froze, and I had shame about that for years. If anything hard happened to me again or scary, I would obviously freeze, because I'm this weak, terrible, helpless, hopeless person. And so I couldn't handle difficult things or conflict. So I chose safe relationships. So your trauma response was selected way before you could think about it. But it's so confusing. And because, again, the blood is here, it's in this part of our brain, we haven't got the date selection or the times. You don't actually remember the exact sort of sequence of events. The police force in the UK are beginning to get trained in EMDR and trauma to say, listen, if I'm giving you an account of something that happened, I'm not necessarily lying, but if I've been, say, the victim or witnessed a traumatic event, because this wasn't available at the time, this prefrontal cortex area, I might get it mixed up. Mm-hmm. But what's is your brain is tagging the whole time. So although you're not functionally thinking in this part of your brain, your prefrontal cortex, you're in fight, flight, freeze, flop and fawn, you're in there, it's keeping you alive. And guess what? It did keep you alive. The system did a smart thing then.
Right.
But it's tagged stuff for later that you might need later. So this is where trauma is a bit of a wicked mistress. So then you could be walking along and people might say, oh, are you afraid of the stairs now? You know, you're
sort of,
or if you've been in a car accident, say, you might not be afraid of driving again. But say you were in a car accident and the car that hit you was a red car. You could be in a supermarket, doing a grocery store, doing a big shop. You could see a flash of red outside and that could instantly trigger you.
Mm-hmm.
And why am I feeling panicked and anxious in the store? I've always been okay coming here. And because we don't understand it, it can start manifesting into anxiety. And then we think we're out of control, but it's out of control and it can start taking over. So trauma is an exquisite system, network that's designed to keep us alive. But there hasn't been enough information on, I think, maybe like aftercare for trauma so that people understand, A, what happened to you in the moment was automated.
Yeah.
No choice. You had no choice in what you did. It was done for you. You didn't choose it. So people don't know that. So they carry these fears, the shame language. So yours might be from running away. I am afraid, or I am, you said you chose safe relationships. I'm not enough, or I am helpless. You know, we could end up choosing all these different jobs, relationships, scenarios, places to live according to this I am belief. So if I can give you anything today about that, you didn't choose it. There's no way you would have or could have chosen.
Yeah. And a lot of what's showing up, you think, later in life is the tagging of what the brain has tagged. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like if you walk past someone and they've got the aftershave of an ex-boyfriend.
Right.
Or you are instantly transported back to the guy that was the right?
Yeah.
Because that, whoa, it's a so similar thing that you might not remember words that were said, but there'll be something that you remember clear as day, like the color of the carpet or where the window was or what color something was in your neighbor's house. Or you'll remember something so specific from that memory. But there'll be often people say, I don't remember what they said. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to type, I can't remember what they said, but I can clearly remember a smell, a sound, something in the environment that's so clear. And again, like it could be a curtain fabric that then 20 years later, you're walking through a beautiful department store and there's the latest collection by so-and-so has got something in those patterns and you could absolutely be re-triggered and you wouldn't necessarily know why or link the two together. So I think that there's, and I'm really pleased about it, there's some beautiful people working in this space that are bringing some more language and awareness to it, because as soon as you understand that you are not wrong, like what you did was chosen for you, there's nothing easy to say, but there's nothing to hold guilt about because you had no option in doing that. The only cure for shame is self-compassion. And in that moment, I hope you can start to have some self-compassion for that little girl then that was forced into a trauma response. And that was the one of five that got picked out of the bag. Literally, that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you can carry the shame of your parents?
So yes, the way that when I work through sort of trauma certifications is that you can have trauma from something you've witnessed. Now I've had a client who witnessed somebody, there was very, very bad turbulence on the plane, seatbelts on, can't get up, and somebody didn't make it to the toilet in time. Mm-hmm. So because that would happen if you're on a flight and all the rest of it.
Sure.
It happened to them. They took on the shame, the humiliation, mm-hmm. the feeling of that, and it manifested into them being so paranoid before flying, wouldn't have even a sip of water that day. So if they're going, so I mean, if anyone's been dehydrated, it makes you feel very anxious.
Yeah.
So you're really feeling anxious. It's because worried about the feeling of humiliation. So that's shame and humiliation can be real bedfellows as well.
Yeah. And I think about like how that translates into a woman's life in her 20s and her 30s. And I hear a lot of people say that women choose partners or men like their fathers. I don't know if that's true. I do want to ask you that question. And then are we trying to work out our childhoods in relationships?
There's the most amazing book by Dr. Harville Hendrick. And it's called, I'm sure it's called Getting the Love You Want, How to Get the Love You
Want.
Yeah,
I think I've heard of that book. Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Harville Hendrick, quite an unusual name. So, and in it, he discusses the fact that romantic relationships are designed to complete our childhoods. And generally speaking, but not always, you are attracted to the negative traits of your opposite sex caregiver in a partner. Mm-hmm. But if it's not the case, like I definitely married my mother, you know, so like it doesn't have to be like, you know, like indifferent. And I mean, very lovingly towards my ex-husband, we get on very well. But yeah. Like that we go into romantic relationship with stuff, with our wounds, but we are attracted to people that often have these negative traits of one of our caregivers in our systems. And the sort of longing behind it's really beautiful, actually, because we get into these cycles where you think, it's not thinking, it's all subconscious, but you're like, well, if I can love them enough, it's almost like you get to complete the level of the game, then somehow I can make them love me, or I can have been enough for my parents, or if I can get this partner to love me and take notice of me and value me and think of me as clever and beautiful and all of these things, and it'll mean that my parents did too. And we're not going into a relationship thinking that. And I'd recommend that everybody reads this book. It's an older style book. Marie Forleo, I heard her recommend it first, and it's just brilliant.
Okay.
And it talks about all the ways that we try and exit relationships, how we try and avoid intimacy. So overwork, for example, because it's almost like a celebrated way of, I'm sorry, I've got to work. You know, I'm doing my work, but we're avoiding intimacy because we're getting triggered by people. And the same, and another terrific book, if people want a recommendation, is The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks, which is wonderful. And it talks about how we get the most triggered, if you like, by another person, by a romantic partner. That's the way you're going to get high. You're going to get the most activated. So the way to manage that, especially in early dating, is to have lots of autonomy, to basically come back to center and just manage the high, those sorts of things, just especially when you're early dating, because it's very easy to get overwhelmed. But he also talks about how when we find, say, a really good relationship, and maybe we're not used to, and it's ticking our boxes, we might be inclined to self-sabotage.
Right.
Because we go back to some limiting beliefs about ourselves. In my case, I am bad. Well, if I'm bad, this lovely person is going to find that out, or whatever, or avoid someone that's more dynamic that might be a better choice for me. So I'll self-sabotage instead because I am bad, and therefore I can't possibly consider having a really fulfilling, terrific romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. So yes, I do think we bring a lot of our childhoods into romantic relationship. And I was reading another book this weekend that talked about, it's about art and writing and just really how we have to just get on with it, basically, and we procrastinate. And it's that we kind of build up this tolerance, almost like a muscle of resistance. So you'll do anything but the thing you're scared of.
Right.
And then romantic relationships. So we're really scared of being hurt. You know, I'm scared of fully loving somebody because fundamentally what I'm afraid of is being alone. And right. That's not necessarily lonely. That's being with myself completely alone, not using the work, exercise, anything else, addictions, whatever it might be. For me to be completely alone, we fear it. So taking a leap into a project we've always wanted to do, or changing a business, or either leaving a relationship or really opening ourselves up to one, all of the same fears are around the fact that fundamentally we're afraid of this, of ourselves, of just being with ourselves. And I put a post out today about kind of why it's so important to really love yourself first, which sounds, everyone says it and you're like, oh,
I do that too. I'm like, just stop.
When I say, love myself. Oh my God, just love myself. When you're down, you're like, but how? And the answer is just tiny steps of being okay with you without distraction.
Mm-hmm.
That self-love is maybe going for a walk, and even the first 5 minutes, not having music on, just being with yourself. It's like an evening when you're at home alone and not having like three devices on the go all at once. Again, even if it's just for 5 minutes, like, to me, self-love and really being okay with yourself is exactly that. It's just being able to be alone and okay with yourself.
Yeah.
And heap of distraction. And it doesn't have to be journaling and bubble bulbs and all of this sort of stuff and going out and buying yourself flowers. If you want to, amazing. But it's like, it doesn't have to be that.
Yeah.
It can literally be just spending some time with yourself and building that muscle up.
Yeah. I've been doing this thing really, very recently where I'm like, how can I be more connected to this moment that I'm having? Like this, for example, recording this, but also like when I'm washing the dishes, right? Like, how can I be connected to this moment? How can I just find some depth in my own life? I'll tell you why I started doing that. It's because I recently moved into a new home. And when I first moved, and it's a new city as well, when I first moved, I was like, every Friday night, every Saturday night, I have to go to dinner. I am not going to be this person that just stays at home by themselves, like, you know, just, I don't know, watching TV or whatever. I wanted to have a great social life, but also I think I was kind of avoiding something. And now on the weekends, if I don't have a dinner, and I used to have anxiety if I didn't have a dinner plan on a Friday night, I felt like my life is spiraling downwards, right? Like it has less of a meaning of some sort. And now I have a completely full life. I go bike riding, I walk, and I'm always like thinking like, how can I be more connected to this moment? And I sometimes that when I go to dinner, I'm like, man, you could replace these people with a vase and I would just still be having a great time by myself, you know, just finding deeper moments within the present moment, I guess.
I really love that you've said that. And having just been away for the weekend on my own in a very fabulous hotel where it was all couples. I mean, I was the only person sat on my own the whole time. And you did kind of have to force yourself into it a little bit to start, like sitting at dinner and just, oh, I had the best time. I loved it. I love my own company. I didn't always. I used to be exactly as you say. When you talk about that, it was so resonant. I was that person that after my husband and I separated, when he would have my daughter, who at the time, you know, she's 3 and a half, we broke up. And that, the sort of the 4-day weekend, I had every 2 weeks, I was, I mean, back to back, not a second that wasn't filled with an activity, a trip, a person, a, you know, a night out, a this, a that, and all the things that you mentioned. Because guess what? I absolutely wasn't ready to be on my own. Mm-hmm. And then for me, it was a blessing that we had lockdown fairly quickly afterwards. And to be honest, the first lockdown probably still didn't really deal with it. And it was in the UK, we had 2. So it was the second lockdown. And I was like, right, do you know what? I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Like, I made sure there wasn't a single guy that I was messaging, not one. And that's honestly the first time, not arrogant, but just that was the first time there wasn't, you know, a person just safely, you know, hi, how are you? Good morning, whatever. Good night. Not one message. The more and more and more I did it, the more and more I built that muscle, exactly as you're talking, more and more I got into simple pleasures. I understood myself. And I think that's what I'm hearing from you is I understood I am the sum of many parts. I do need to go out. I do need to spend time with friends and need to travel. I need like terrific sexual connection. Like, pleasure is a hugely important part of my life, massively important. And I think women need to own that and be in a place of receiving and all of that. I think it's such a beautiful place to be, to own that femininity as well. Mm-hmm. There's so many parts I need to geek out on, leadership stuff. Like I am many, many, many different things, and all of it's like a patchwork of kind of who I am. And it was that time that got me to realize it. And I crave my own company now. I've not had enough, you know, I've pulled in a lot of directions. I'm like, oh, please, almost let me have like a lockdown evening. Like, I almost want to have one of these evenings where it's just me getting back to self. And that was the best thing I could have done. And what it did was it made my benchmark go so much higher of what I would accept from anything, like friendships, dating, work, everything, because I didn't have that fear of being by myself. Like, I don't want to go for that coffee and talk about that meeting because your company isn't aligned to my values. It really did raise my bar so high. And it was learning to truly be by myself, like really be alone with me. And it also just tells me that, you know, in dating or anything like that, like you can never control what's going to happen. And I think that this is something I talk to my friends and clients, and I see it a lot with Instagram. Things can come out of the blue, like left field. We can't control other people. And that's friendships as well. A lot of friendships ending. I talk a lot about that and get a lot of messages about it. all you can know, and obviously we can be upset and we should not have our emotions, is that fundamentally you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that I believed that was really being okay by myself, completely by myself. Like, you know, I was like entertaining myself.
Yeah.
Myself. Yeah. And almost smiling, because my daughter and I, we go on holiday a lot together on our own. And I would do it when she was little. We'd travel all over the world. And often it's just me and her. Mm-hmm. And there's the one day I'll write a book called Is It Just the Two of You? Because you're looking around for like, where's the man coming to pay? Or how can it just be the two of you? You know, you and a young child. And
right.
I always think, God, there were times when that was very triggering and upsetting. But we have the best time. We sit in restaurants and we chat and we laugh. And I can look around and seeing so many people that are maybe not having the same amount of fun that we are and connection. That was the best thing I could ever have done. And I love that you're doing it as well.
Thank you. I mean, and I'm glad to hear someone else is also doing it and also having that experience and feeling the same way. Do you think, and I want to talk a little bit more about relationships, romantic relationships, but before I get to that, do you think that a woman has to have a good relationship with her father to have a good partnership?
No, not at all. I think it's a lot of people wouldn't have maybe have a father figure or had good father figures. I don't want anyone to have any kind of limiting belief that would in some way set them back. Again, it's really everybody has had the most unique experience to get to the point where they are. And have you read The Untethered Soul?
Yes.
By Michael.
I'm saying,
so yeah. You know, he talks about that you could have two identical twins genuinely raised in exactly the same home in exactly the same way, and they would still have a different experience and outlook and personality traits. And so you could almost have like that kind of controlled environment and somebody was still standing the opposite way to you and saw a different thing. So
yeah. No,
I think it really is about understanding you, being honest about places where it's your stuff. I'm good now at knowing when it's my stuff. Like, okay, this is me. I'm being triggered. This is my stuff. This isn't very cool. And my friends and I have got sort of, there's one rule for life, for everybody, for ourselves and for everyone. And the one rule for life is don't be a dick. So for everyone, for relationships, friendships, everything, but also for yourself, like hold yourself accountable. So I just think it's not hard in life to hold yourself accountable to that rule and also to use that as a lens for the other relationships in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a great measuring stick. I also measure myself. I'm like, was I an asshole in that situation? I think I was a little bit. So I'll like recount and then see if I need to apologize to somebody or something. And I want to like kind of talk a little bit about that and vulnerability. This just recently happened to me where I always thought that I was a vulnerable person sharing my feelings. Here in this setting, it comes very naturally to me in interviews of sharing something very deeply personal. When I'm in a romantic relationship and there's some kind of skin in the game, like I'll tell you the other night, I wanted to send a text. I literally looked at my phone for 3 hours and just could not send this. It was a text of, if there's something that I did wrong, I'm happy to apologize. That was just the text. But just, I couldn't send it, you know? And I was like, oh, there was an issue here with vulnerability in me. And I'm kind of wondering, what is that about? I know that I'm not the only one that I hear that goes through that. A lot of like people that are in the dating arena have an issue with being vulnerable. I think it's probably to do with rejection and whatnot. But what can you share about that?
It's really interesting that you say that. I think as women as well, we can also take on, because of conditioning and, you know, all the fun stuff, be a good girl, don't make a scene, don't be too much,
right.
be kind. And so sometimes we can feel like maybe, I obviously don't know the scenario, but you were reaching out to sort of say whether you needed to apologize or not.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that how often do we go there to make it okay? Because maybe we feel like, oh, maybe I overstepped the mark.
Yes.
And is that genuine? Or is that I was tired and I was unskillful. Sorry about that. And I do that. I didn't feel like I was my best self. Sorry.
Yeah.
Or is it doing it to make sure everything stays okay because we've got to be a good girl and we've got to...
Guilt or something driven by something else.
Right. And also, you know, not enjoying conflict and other things. So I would say there's definitely things to look at. There's a lot of cultural conditioning and stuff about being female in that space as well. There's a really great friend of mine, Amy Chan, who has written an incredible book called The Breakup Bootcamp. She's brilliant. And recently, when I was speaking to her privately about some events and stuff, and I was like, oh, I'm going on a date tonight. Have you got any advice for me, first date? And she went, yeah. And it's some of the best dating advice I've ever been given. She said, there are two questions and two questions only you need to ask yourself. Mm-hmm. Am I having fun? Would I like to see them again? Right. She said, because everything else is you in your head. Oh, it won't work because of this. Oh, I really like that. I wonder what their bath time is. Can I get his chart? Like, oh, this is a bit difficult. Oh, they live an hour away. Well, this, you know,
yeah.
Oh, but that won't work. Or this is great. You know, we end up going, like, anxiety can be defined as the inability to access the present. And she just said, they're the only two things you can ask yourself. I think it's for at least the first 5 dates or more. And it keeps you out of your head. Honestly, she saved me hours of anxiety.
Yeah.
As well. It can stop miscommunication. It can stop you. You know, there was a scenario when I went on a date.
Yeah.
Well, I've got a few curiosities about this person. Like, I really like them, but I've got a few curiosities. And I said, look, there's a story that I'm telling myself, which is da-da-da, but I don't want to make this up. I'd like to hear from you. And then I'll decide if this has any like longevity or not. And I was so off the mark. I can't tell you. Like, so thank goodness for Amy, because yeah, I was like somewhere else in my pinball machine. And because she'd said, those are the two things you live by. And if you stop having fun, and if you don't want to see them again, like, it's pretty much all you need to know.
Right, right. And also you were vulnerable in that moment of sharing, like, this is the story that's going on in my head too, you know, like you're willing to go there because you wanted to really just know. And I guess you ask for what you want, which I don't think a lot of women do. I feel like I'm always ordering exactly what I want off the menu, exactly the drink that I want. What do you think is the importance of a woman asking for what she wants within the relationship or being single?
Yeah. I love that you brought this up because I have done like a gazillion courses and in weird and wonderful settings as well. And one of them was a female sexual empowerment course.
Yeah.
And just women, and we're doing all these things. And the overriding theme, two things from everyone and all these different courses, I don't know how to ask for what I want. And I take too long to receive. And that's not just sexual pleasure receiving. It's I'm taking too long to decide.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking too long to receive. Or you feel like you have to earn it first. Like, yeah. I can't just receive a compliment.
Right.
I have to make my house perfect. Or I have to look perfect to get the compliment or to feel worthy of it. Like, I can't order 3 desserts and try a spoonful of each because that would give me the most pleasure. I better be a good girl, or I don't want to look too much. And again, we're in our head. And I can tell you, as someone that's 42 and has been through a marriage, this is exactly what happens, is you start off being the good girl and you start off maybe trying to be perfect. And it's from insecurity, and it's not from trying to be nice. It's not from being Machiavelli or trying to mislead people or manipulate
right.
it. It's due to like low insecurity or confidence. So anyone listening, every single woman on all these courses all said, I don't know how to ask the most terrifying thing. Like, they would have got the biggest spider out your house or 4th snake. The idea of asking maybe even a partner that you've got trust with, please don't touch me like that. That actually hurts. Could you touch me like this?
Yeah.
Or, I prefer if we do this. Or do you know what? I'd really love it if we went to that restaurant tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Or just literally putting your needs in. This beautiful example about going for dinner with someone. And exactly your example, perhaps, of some friends, it's that what you want to drink, and you're like, oh, well, I'll just have whatever you're having.
Uh-huh.
And you need a bottle of champagne, but they ordered the red. And then you're having dinner, and you maybe order you wanted the lobster pasta, but you had like a lid. And then the dessert menu comes, and you say, oh, no, I'm fine. And you watch them drooling like a dog when they're eating their like beautiful creme brulee. And then 20 years later, or 10 years later, when he orders the red, because that's what you like, and you blow up, and you're like, why do you never ask me what I want, or why didn't meet my needs? And he's like, you never told me.
Yeah.
You know, and it becomes this cycle of like some resentment that we're not having our needs met, but we have to give partners, friends, anybody in our life, we have to give them the opportunity to really get to know us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is saying what it is that we do and don't like. And I've got a lot of male friends. I remember going on these courses and chatting to the boys and being like, what do you think about this? And, and all of them, there is nothing sexier than a woman that knows what she wants. There is nothing more attractive than a woman that orders and is clearly enjoying herself. That's what they said. There is nothing more attractive than a woman that's like, do you know what? I really don't fancy that tonight. Can we try this? And, you know, and is enjoying it. And that's also, I think, the same looking at work and gender pay gap. Like, all of the evidence is there about, there is a lot of work to be done in that space, but the evidence states that when we start, say, from a graduate role in the same position as a man, they're going to be so far ahead. And there's some looking into that now that it's because men are pushing at every opportunity, not even just the annual review, like every opportunity to get a raise. And they're doing it. Whereas we're maybe going to wait and then hope and probably just accept. Thank you very much, even though it's not good enough at all. So, and that's not a blanket statement, obviously. It's me giving an example again about needs and asking for what we want. So there may be a scenario for people listening to try that out. Like, you know, even with friends, maybe you're always in a friendship group. And again, you don't really like being the one to say, oh, I don't really like going to that bar. So just try expressing your needs. And generally speaking, they're going to be not only received well, but celebrated. I think that's the vulnerability block, is expressing our needs and being okay that they are my needs.
What would you tell a woman that wants to start speaking up for herself in a relationship, maybe, and doesn't know where to begin or how to start?
There's a very good app called Kama, K-A-M-A, that a good friend of mine runs, Chloe McIntosh. And that is for couples. So you both have the app downloaded. You both get sent a question and you won't get the answer shared unless you've both answered it. If you've been in a long-term relationship, it's actually very difficult to bring up some of these subjects.
Right.
Actually, the last 5 years, I don't really like how you've been touching me there. How can I go back on that now? I've told them that I really love this wine and how can I change it? So this is a really lovely thing. It's probably questions that you don't necessarily answer. Neither of you will get the answer revealed unless you've both done it. So that's really nice. There's lots of the card decks are really good as well. Like the relationship card decks, they're very helpful. Mm-hmm. Another thing to try and do is having a difficult conversation, again, is better done on a walk. Or if you think about why you have a big conversation, you're driving the car. If you're walking, you're connected still. You're side by side, maybe you're in holding hands, but you're not having to look into each other's eyes, which can feel overwhelming for a lot of people, then get very flooded. And also when you're walking, your eyes are scanning the horizon. They're doing lateral eye movement, which is what we do in EMDR, in eye movement processing, which is keeping your prefrontal cortex online. So you're not living out of your emotional center. You're going to be able to maintain your rationality and maintain sort of more groundedness. And by walking, you're discharging stress as well, the physical movement of. So that's a beautiful way to introduce. And you're maybe always having those conversations, say, in that environment rather than in the bedroom, in the living room, wherever it may be. You can almost sort of have an environment. And again, designing it, if we're looking at with a partner, when is a good time to do that? We'll go out for a walk on a Sunday morning. We make it a ritual. We have like a check-in about our relationship. You can make it, like I say, use the cards, use the app to sort of introduce things. But I just want to say again, it is really difficult. And one of the exercises on these courses that they got us to do was to blindfold somebody. So what we did in the exercise was you blindfolded your partner in this exercise and you just spoke the needs into their ear. And it was so much easier. It was so much easier doing that without the pressure of eye contact.
Yeah. I almost guarantee, like your friend mentioned, that there's nothing better about a woman that enjoys herself and can speak what she wants. And I think about that dynamic with what I find attractive in a man. Like, there, to me, there's nothing sexier about like him knowing what he wants in life, career-wise, him having his own thing, like in certain scenarios, just like being able to so easily make decisions. I find that so sexy. It's like a masculine part of a guy that I really enjoy and also have taken on in my own life, right? Like, I have that masculine part of myself where like I'm a very A-type personality. So I think that when I've displayed it, I think men have been more attracted to that part of me because there's a whole other slew of women. They're like, I don't know. Do I want pizza? They don't know. And I can see how that is very unattractive. So I think if there's any argument to say what you want and to really believe it, and just if you feel it, let your insides match your outsides
and just kind of just go for it. And also, if you're with a person and you go, you say what you want and they shut you down, that's a whole different problem. You know, that's a different thing that you really considering. Yeah.
Yeah. A bit like the other scenario, I'd rather just say that this is what I'm sort of telling myself, like, you know, just want to find out about you. And if that was accurate, like I say, that would have been it, you know, because it wouldn't be point continuing it. And you're making it really beautiful. I love what you were saying there. Because if we imagine that in a friendship, you know, you know when someone's keeping something, like when they're holding back, and it can come across as being a bit shady. Mm-hmm. And it's never the intention of a romantic relationship. It's anxiety, it's wanting to be well-liked. As I said, there's a lot of the good girling and all this sort of stuff. If you think about that in a friendship dynamic, say when a friend has not fully showing up, or you see them do it in a relationship and you're like, oh God. And it's a bit, you know, I joke with one of my best friends. She started dating this guy and actually they had a lovely relationship for a long time. But all of a sudden, she started talking about all the outdoor pursuits they were doing. I remember being like, what? Like, she's not. That they were going to be buying waterproof jackets and going on walks up mountains. She's wonderful. She's not someone that does outdoor pursuits. So you can see people sort of taking things on and always being a bit of a chameleon. I would say, look at that with yourself. And if you catch yourself going into chameleon, you know, maybe sort of adapting. We make compromises, but we don't make big changes. Like self-abandon. We don't move away from who we are at our essence that we've got to know through realizing we enjoy our own company. Because fundamentally, it's setting that relationship up for a fall anyway. And if we start pretending in any way, shape, or form, over time, that's going to get bigger. In long-term relationship, there are challenges and stuff gets, life happens, things get difficult. You know, so you need to make sure you've got a really good foundation. And I can tell you this as someone who's, you know, in their 40s and has been through a long-term marriage and through the other side. If something isn't right at the beginning, it's not going to get more right, especially when life happens and you've got withdrawals from the relationship because you're tired or your new parents or whatever it might be. If you've got some big differences, and especially if you've been band-aiding or masking to try and be perfect, that is really going to show up in different times. So I would say absolutely, just, you know, give yourself the opportunity to have a full relationship. And that means fully showing up, showing all of yourself.
Yeah, yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I think it's only served me. Like, I was also married too before. I didn't mention it earlier, but I became the scientist of myself through that experience. And I left that experience knowing so much more about myself, so much more about what I want, and so much more about what I didn't want in a relationship. And I think that kind of launched me into really going deeper, really appreciating the moments that I was in, really creating and designing a life for myself that I really enjoyed with or without a partner. I could talk to you about all kinds of things for a very long time. I'm so excited that we did get to talk about some other things. So I would love to have you back on to talk about some of these other things. But I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you taking this time to really delve into some of these subject matters. So thank you so much.
It's absolutely been a pleasure.
And have a great rest of the night.
You darling. Loved it.
Bye.
Loved it.
Bye.